Bionabu presents the MedTech Podcast. If you're intrigued and want to learn more about how technology is changing healthcare, then this podcast is perfect for you. If you want to learn about entrepreneurship and innovation, then stick around. My name's Ash, and welcome to the conversation. Welcome back to the MedTech Podcast. In today's episode, I'm delighted to be joined with Dr. Nick Gompertz. He's the CEO and founder of EarSwitch. Dr. Gompertz is an ex-UK-based GP with a passion for transforming the lives of people with disability. So he founded his company EarSwitch, and they are developing groundbreaking technology that allows users to control devices using a tiny muscle in the ear, the tensor tympani. The company's key products, though, have far-reaching applications in various fields, from medical monitoring to revolutionizing the gaming industry. Join me as I explore Dr. Gompertz's journey, the incredible potential of EarSwitch's technology, and the company's role in shaping the future of assisted tech. And as always, please make sure you hit that follow button and give the episode a like rating. Let's get into this episode. So Nick, great to have you on the podcast. Please give a brief introduction.
Hi, thanks very much for having me on. So I've been an NHS doctor for 30 years, and the last 21 of those was as GP. I had an idea of how to help people with motor neuron disease communicate when I was a medical student, fourth year medical student, I think, as well. And I didn't realize how to do it until 5 years ago. And then everything took off. And I stopped being a GP just under 2 years ago to take this on full time.
Yeah. So let's go back to that initial idea of fourth year medical school. Obviously, I'm fourth year medicine at the moment. And to think of an idea extraordinary as this, right? Where did that idea come from? You must have had something that sparked the initial idea.
It was actually visiting a local hospice that we all did as part of our rotation. And I met someone with motor neuron disease, but they had bulbar motor neuron disease, so a fairly rare form where you lose your speech before you lose your muscle control elsewhere. And at that point, the best technology that was out there, which was pretty groundbreaking at the time, was something called a light writer, which was like a keyboard with an LED display. So people could actually type out their words and it would read. We wouldn't even read them back. It'd just be a ticker tape LED display effectively and would show what they're writing. And this person was rapidly losing the ability to use their fingers, which would obviously happen pretty quickly. And I just thought he was losing the ability to communicate. And I always knew I could move a muscle in my ear. I didn't know what it was. And I just thought, I wonder if there's some way of sort of hands-free controlling things. And that sort of festered in my mind for about 30 years. I came back to it intermittently. I was thinking about things like audio tympanometry, which is where you seal the canal and you emit a sound and then you pick up the change in the sound vibration. Who wants to go around with a sealed ear canal and a continuous tone in their ear? People complain about tinnitus. I couldn't work out how to do it until 5 years ago when my children were watching a CBBC documentary on an amazing 13-year-old called Jonathan Bryan. And he'd just written a book. He's nonverbal. He's got severe cerebral palsy with involuntary head movements, so athetoid cerebral palsy, and also a intermittent squint that varies from one eye to the other. So he can't use eye tracking. And his mother had taken him out of special school age 7 because they weren't teaching him. Well, they were looking after him, but not teaching him. And she knew he was intelligent. So she took him out, taught him to read and write using a physical spelling board. So basically letters stuck onto a Perspex board. And his mum and his carer, he'd be sat on his mum's lap, his carer was sitting on the other side, and they'd look to see which letter he was looking at, and they taught him to read and write. And so that was age 7. By age 13, he had written this book called Wow. I Can Write, just with his eyes. And I just thought there had to be a better way.
Yeah, definitely. It's an extraordinary story there. And so it'll be good to get on to firstly, what was there in the market beforehand, before you started doing all this research? What was there to help people with, for example, motor neuron disease who had just had, or potentially just had a stroke, had lost the ability to communicate? What is there at the moment? Everyone knows the story of Stephen Hawking, right?
Absolutely.
But let's break down the technology that there was currently.
I guess looking at the people, the conditions that cause this, obviously there's motor neuron disease, or ALS, as they call it in the States, for anyone listening over there, is progressive loss of muscle control. And Stephen Hawking is obviously the archetypal person that everyone remembers, but apparently it can affect 1 in 300 people. So it's got a lot more common than people, I think, realize. There's people with cerebral palsy. With severe cerebral palsy, they can be nonverbal, and also people with brainstem strokes, so locked-in syndromes, which is brainstem strokes. And so it depends on where people are in that journey as to what technology was available. The sort of gold standard is eye tracking. As we saw with Jonathan, the eye tracking wouldn't work for him because his intermittent squints and his rotary head movements. That is good, and you'll see some people with very high communication rates with that, but it's very difficult if you can't select what you're looking at. So the ideal mode of eye tracking is eye tracking with a switch. And so obviously a lot of these people can't use a switch. People can use sip and puff sometimes, but they can't use a standard switch. So sip and puff is basically a straw with a switch on it that picks up whether you use a sip or puff on it. But with people with later stage motor neuron disease, and then they have to use dwell to select. So not only do you have to hold your eye gaze onto a letter for long enough for it to highlight it, you then have to hold that gaze for long enough for it to then select half a second or something like that, which doesn't sound very much. But actually, when you try it, your eyes are all over the place. You never stop. And that's actually to dwell long enough to highlight an icon as well as to select it is really tiring. And you get what they call the Midas touch. You look at something and it selects through. And so that's, it's good in some people. Some people are very good at it. Other people just hate it. And then there's, once people are past that, then you get this sort of switch scanning technology that Professor Stephen Hawking used, where you use one simple switch to control a complex on-screen keyboard or on-screen interface, so a graphical interface. Stephen Hawking had still some residual movement or control of a cheek muscle. So he had mounted to his glasses an infrared sensor that picked up cheek muscle movement. And so on the screen that was produced between him and Intel, specifically for him, there was a on-screen keyboard and it would automatically highlight each row at a time in sequence. And when it got to the row with the letter on that he was interested on, he would move his cheek muscle. So that actually acted as a switch. So then it would start scanning across those letters, highlighting one at a time. And when it reached the letter he wanted, he'd move his cheek muscle again. And so that's extremely laborious way of doing things, but sometimes that's the only option. We're replacing that from the simplest way, a form of ear switch. We're just replacing that switch with something that's a bit more ubiquitous, that sits in the ear very nicely, doesn't have to be repositioned every time someone moves or is moved by their carer. So that's really where we are at the moment.
Yeah, great. And tell me a bit about ear switch now. You know what? It's funny because before the podcast, I was obviously writing podcast notes, doing some research, and I saw that you guys use the movement of the tensor tympani in the middle ear. And so I sat there for about 5 minutes trying to activate this muscle, because I noticed on YouTube you have a video talking about this rumbling noise when you tense this muscle it's one of the smallest muscles in the body, right? You get this rumbling noise. And so I sat there for about five minutes trying to activate it, and you know what? I got it. I got this rumbling noise, and I was thinking, you know what? When I yawn, I get this as well. And so it's a muscle we all have but just don't notice. So tell me about how ear switch is different and how you're using this to revolutionize a new way of communicating.
It's interesting. I find it interesting. Obviously, I'm fascinated by it, but there's a whole Reddit subcommunity, so a social media subcommunity called Ear Rumblers Assemble, and there's 96,000 ear rumblers on it. So these are people who are so obsessed with squeezing a muscle in their body that they quite often they say it's a useless superpower, and I'm saying it's not. It's absolutely fantastically useful. It's not just me, is one thing. The other thing we find is that there are waves of people joining that Reddit subcommunity, and they either come in from two camps. One camp is, I can't believe I've got a superpower. I thought everyone could do this, because if you can do it, you can do it. You think everyone can do it. And the other thing is people coming in and go, thank goodness I found my tribe. I talk to people about this. They look at me completely blankly. So you have this sort of complete sort of variation on how people come to it. So the first real formal thing we did with this was with the University of Bath. We applied for a National Institute for Health Research grant to validate that this was actually potentially useful. And we did a survey of 2,000 people. 55% of people said that they'd been doing it since childhood. It was just normal for them. And they describe it as the Reddit community as people using it to block out their annoying teachers. So they can use it to muffle their hearing, or to, when you clash the dishes, when you take them out of the dishwasher, to protect your hearing before, in advance, knowing that it's going to happen. Some people use it for beatboxing, as a rhythm, and beat along to their music. And people have competitions as to how long they can hold it for. So some people say they can hold it indefinitely. I can hold it for about a minute. Other people can do it for minutes at a time. And then also competing whether they can, they've got individualized control. Can they control one ear or both ears? So classically, people seem to have one dominant ear that they control better all by itself, and the other one has to be in conjunction with the other side. So there's a whole sort of subterranean science going on, teaching science going on with people discussing that. We also know that people, the commonest way to describe it, if people don't understand or aren't doing it already, is exactly what you said. When you yawn, if you notice when you yawn, you can't hear as well, or your hearing's a bit muffled, or you get a rumbling noise or a tension in your ears or a fullness, that is the muscle contracting. And what we found in our survey, which was just describing it in a quick survey, was 80% or 85% of people could recognize it when they're yawning. And we also know that people can learn how to do it exactly as you described. My favorite story was someone said that when they were at primary school, their friend told them how they got this superpower. He was so jealous. He spent days learning how to do it and then had done it by the end. So we know it is learnable. We don't know at the moment how many people can learn it, but that's just our basic. That's where we started. But ear switch has got so much more capacity than that.
You know, it's a bit of a funny story, quite embarrassing, actually. I remember being about 6 years old and having done it for the first time a while ago and then just forgetting I'd done it, but it brought back memories. And I remember sitting there 6 years old and trying to move an object, like there was probably like a remote control in front of me, and then tensing this muscle and then hearing this rumbling and thinking, oh my gosh, is this a superpower? Is this telekinesis that I have, that I'm trying to move this object? Yeah, so it's really funny. I'm not surprised at all that there's a whole Reddit community on it, because there's pretty much a Reddit community on anything. And if I remember correctly from, forgive me if I'm wrong, obviously, because I did anatomy in first year, which was 3 years ago now. So if I remember correctly, this muscle, it will control the malus, right? And so it almost dampens sound.
I had to learn a lot because I thought it's stapedius. I knew that there was a muscle in the ear. I'd forgotten there were two. And so yeah. I always thought it's stapedius. So my first folders are still that are on my iPad say stapedius. But actually, oh, it's not. It's the tenor tympani. So I'd misnamed it. It's the second smallest muscle in the body, I believe, because the stapedius is the smallest. So the tenor tympani basically runs from the middle of the malleus, which is the, obviously, as you'll know, is the ossicular bone that is just embedded on into the back of the eardrum. But runs as a sort of strap-like muscle. It runs internally, so to the base of the skull. And so it tenses, as the name, it does tense the eardrum. There have been quite a few theories as to what it was there for, and I think some of them are wrong. People have mentioned in the past it was for tuning the eardrum, but people have said it was a residual muscle leftover, or vestigial muscle leftover from when we were insectivores, where we had to listen to high-pitched wing beat of insects so that we could find them when we were little rodents, or before we were humans. But that doesn't make sense to me, because if it's vestigial, why have we all got a muscle? Why is it not just a tendon? And why has every mammal, except for some unusual subterranean mole rats, not, why has every mammal got it except for some of these mammals? It's also been described as protecting the hearing against loud noises, but its response rate isn't quick enough to actually protect. And then people say it's to protect your hearing against thunder, prolonged loud noise. Where's the evolutionary advantage to that? So I believe, going back to that original discussion about it tuning the eardrum, I think it's actually an active tuner of the eardrum, both to the frequency you're listening to, because obviously, just like a kettle drum, if you pull a kettle drum diaphragm tighter, it resonates a different frequency. So I think if we're pulling the eardrum tighter, it resonates at a different frequency that's coming in. So it actually allows you to hear better the sounds that you're listening for. So when you're in the cocktail party scenario where it's very loud and you're trying to listen to one person, you're straining to hear, I think that's exactly the right term. You are straining this muscle to listen to that person, to their frequencies.
So it's a wonderful little muscle, right? We've gone from talking about these Redditors that I think they have superpowers, to now homing down on what it, evolutionary speaking, what it's actually there for. So what was it about this muscle that you thought, you know what, I might be on something? What was it about this muscle that has led you now to step out of being a GP and home in and I guess focus the rest of a couple of years on this journey of creating this solution?
I think it's the standard thing, which I didn't understand. I knew nothing about startups, innovation. I'd sat in my GP surgery for 21 years and everything just revolved around that. So I didn't even know there are ecosystems regarding startups. But so one of the classic things that they say, I now know in retrospect, is it's the pain point you need to identify. Don't come up with a technology solution, come up with what the problem is. And the problem really was people losing the ability to communicate. And I just had this idea of actually I might be able to help. So that was really where it came from. And just in that process, I realized that this classic thing that if you resolve an accessibility issue for those most in need, you actually resolve it for everybody. So like texting was obviously designed for people who couldn't use phones because of a hearing loss. And we're all using it, and WhatsApp effectively for it is from texting, isn't it? So it's all come out to the general community. So the idea that a hands-free control would be useful for someone who's got motor neuron disease, suddenly realized that actually we all want a hands-free control. When you're in the middle of listening to your podcast and my wife comes and talks to me, I have to go and take my gardening gloves off and tap my AirPod to stop it and say stop. Whereas actually, if you could just stop it with a click of an ear, or you can skip a track, or you can ask for a phone, you don't have to put your shopping down, or you can start your GoPro if you're on your mountain bike or on your skiing and you want to record, and with your head count, you've forgotten to put it on. Or, you know, that period of road rage that someone drives past and you go, I wish I had my dash cam on, and you could actually set it going. So anything you want to do hands-free. So we imagine that actually, ultimately, we'd like this in everyone's smart earphones. And the spin round advantage for that is not just for us as a commercial company, because that's really not why I started it, but the positive virtual circle we get then is that we would get the benefit of large-scale manufacturer, people, the big tech companies are expert with miniaturization and with consumerization and also comfort. So imagine if every smart earphone came with the ability for someone with motor neuron disease to communicate, but also us all to use it in our daily lives. So someone who gets motor neuron disease has been using it for the last 10, 20 years just to skip a track. And when they begin to lose the ability to communicate, they just continue to communicate with something they've already learned to do.
Sure. And I guess I want to pause that for, because I did want to talk about the commercial application a bit later on, and I wanted to focus specifically on the medical application first. So how will the medical application of someone, let's say, with motor neuron disease using this ear switch device be different to what you're developing commercially?
In some ways it won't. It will be the simple switch, but we try and actually getting away from the switch because we're a lot more than the switch. Because what we've found is that our sensors do a lot more just by accident. Originally, I basically bought a digital otoscope, looked at my ear, and so with a camera, and I could see the eardrum move intentionally. But what we found as we refined what we're doing is that actually we were getting biological signal from around the same area, from the same sensors. So not only are we picking up movement and flushing with blood supply, but we're also getting respiratory movements as well. You're also picking this up from an area that is not pigmented, whatever your skin color. So suddenly we have a central sensor, so nearer to the heart and brain, so more reliable, that gives us heart rate variability, breathing rate and breathing pattern, which has its own benefits, but also oxygenation. And as I'm sure you'll know, is that there's been a massive issue come out through COVID that finger oximetry has been found to be racially biased, certainly in some situations. And so people with dark skin have been undertreated for COVID because everyone's relying on their oxygen saturations. And that's particularly a problem if you think about silent hypoxia. If someone's got no symptoms and your oxygen saturation is reading reassuringly high, there is no way of detecting silent hypoxia because it's based on what your oxygen saturations. So we have by accident stumbled on, I believe, the first racially inclusive skin color agnostic central oximetry, which I think will be the new global standard of care. Now, you might say I'd say that, but I think the ear is the place to do it, and I think it's a massive advantage. And ultimately, as an ex-GP, we're looking at one device that does all your readings in one go.
Sure, yeah. I was just about to get onto that, actually. If we're already needing to check the temperature of a patient and we're putting in something into their ear, right, it's just... it wastes time having to do each individual thing, having to check the temperature and check their blood pressure, check their sats. And so if we did have one device that fits all, like it just goes into the ear, think about how much time could be saved in, for example, ED, emergency department, where we're already short-staffed, we're already up to our necks in the workload. So I was, on Monday, I did part of the new medical school curriculum is we're supposed to do some night shifts to get ready for junior doctor posts. So I was doing a night shift in ED at the paediatrics hospital in Derbyshire. And I remember there being so many patients that come in And I'd taken a history from a patient, clocked them, triaged them, and we were just waiting for one of the nurses to come and hold with the trolley with the to check temperature, blood pressure, but there weren't enough trolleys. Right? And I was just sat there and thinking that we could be getting on with the examination, getting on for me to hand over to the doctor now, but I can't go to the doctor without all the relevant stats and observations. And so I was thinking, is there a solution out there where it could be portable and one fits all? And it's exciting that this potentially, as you said, could be it.
I'm hoping so. I was just, the only thing I'm a bit disappointed is it was never available when I was working.
Yeah.
But if I can, I feel a little bit guilty having stepped out of clinical. If I can help people in this way to make it quicker for everybody and more reliable. We all know in under five to try and get oxygen sats in a kid who won't stay still is impossible because before you've managed to get a decent signal, they've shifted. And so when you're an old jaded GP who's got the confidence that actually this kid is not septic, you make them bouncing off the walls, they're destroying a surgery, you go, this kid is clinically well. Whereas as we move to more guideline-based medicines where people feel disempowered to make their own decisions, and because oxygen saturations is part of the sepsis protocol, there is a danger that we will overrun casualty with people, kids who you're just not being able to get an oxygen saturation for. And so if we can get a device that actually is easier to use, that we give the parent basically an earphone that they plug into their tablet or their phone. So the kid sits there and watches Peppa Pig, their favorite one, and you monitor them remotely, and they don't know that the thing that in their ear is doing anything other than being a speaker for them.
Yeah.
So that's one of my dreams, is that it'll be called the choximeter, the child oximeter. Yeah.
And tell me a bit about now scaling up the ear switch plants in terms of medical applications. So you've obviously obtained numerous grants and funding. I think I read it was the R4I grant, the Invention for Innovation grant, and is that the same grant where you were funded $1.5 million?
That was us. The $1.5 was our second NIHR grant. So we've been amazingly lucky. We've had a really pretty good strike rate on grants.
Not all of them.
You scatter. You know, you have to scatter because you can't just rely on one. I was just very lucky to get the first one, which gave me confidence to do more. So the first was with this sort of prevalence study. The bigger one, the 1.5 million, is to actually take this to the ear switch as a communication device, to a device that we can get out to people as soon as possible. So hopefully we'll finish that by middle of next year. So hopefully at that point we'll have a regulatory approved device that's simply just for communication for people with communication problems.
Yeah, it's great. And so tell me a bit about now scaling up and the research you're doing in terms of developing this to be a solution, and so it can actually be rolled out for the patients.
We're very much an IP company. We're not looking to become manufacturers because there's a lot of people in these fields, both on the consumer devices where all the smart earphone companies are there. You don't really want to be competing with the likes of Apple and Samsung. You want to be with them. And on the medical device companies, you've got very big medical device suppliers who again have the marketing, the distribution channels, and the ability to go to regulatory a lot quicker. So what we're aiming to do is to demo and prove concept enough for them to actually realize that this is a needed solution. So what we're doing is going through the hoops as if we're going to actually produce a medical device and gain our evidence as we do that.
Yeah, it's a slightly different approach, right?
Absolutely. Partly maybe it's been restricted by my lack of knowledge, in that at the beginning it was just me and I knew I wasn't a IFO manufacturer. Now, as you get more into this, you realize you then bring in the people who can do it. So I'm surrounded by a fantastic team, and you realize it's not just your own skills, it's everyone else's. We could, if we have to, we can go down that route. But so what we, the other thing is, this is a global need. There's a global problem with oximetry. So people are not getting satisfactory care because some finger oximeters are not racially equitable. So there's a known need and a known pull, and we can address that. Now, if we go and develop this ourselves, it will take a very long time for market. But if we can get one of the big companies on board, we can accelerate that so we get that benefit to everybody. And hopefully we have a globally relevant solution. My dream is actually ultimately is that in lower middle income countries, you actually produce a low power version, which is a handheld device, which is a bit powered like a wind-up radio, so, or with a pump handle torch. So basically, it's a low power device. So wherever you are, whether you've got a power source or not, you've got access to reliable biometrics.
Sure. And I know I've been putting you off talking about the application in assistive technology in the gaming industry as well. It's almost the extension of the human brain. It's because my nerd is going to come out in this part. And so I wanted to keep this for after we've discussed all the medical needs, the medical application, to now getting on to actually how you're transforming day-to-day lives for everyday people. And so I remember listening to a podcast and it would speak, it's quite funny, the evolution of if a human needed to go for knowledge, it started off, 50, 60 years ago, having to actually go to the library to get that knowledge. And then a few years later, then obviously the computer was developed, you'd have to actively seek somewhere that had a computer. And then you obviously had your own computer at home. And now you reach into your pocket and you have your phone. But that's still inefficient, right? There's still inefficiencies of having to, as you said, reach down and get your phone when in some situations you can't do that. So tell me a bit about now how this could be used as an extension of the human brain in terms of assistive technology and just transform everyday life.
I guess this is where ear switch is a misnomer now. We started in the switch and now we're in complex control. So we're ear control. We're the next generation. So we believe that we've now got an interface which will replace the computer mouse and will become on the go, effectively three-dimensional computer mouse in your ear. So basically, the amazing thing about the eardrum is not only does it vibrate, it's an input device, it vibrates the sound, which we all know about. It's now an output device because actually not only can you control it as a switch, but also more importantly, your eardrums move with eye movements. So when you look to the left, your left eardrum moves in. When you look to the right, your right eardrum moves in. And when you look up and down, you get a different movement. So now our sensors are picking up where you're looking. But not only where you're looking, if you're doing this in both ears you get convergent eye movements when you're looking close to, it's actually picking up what depth of focus you have, so your visual intent.
Wow.
So that has amazing implications on AR and VR. So obviously AR and VR have been slightly hampered by how you control these devices. Either you have controllers or it's hand movement, but it's not very intuitive. And if you're an engineer with your hands in the middle of some sort of device or machine that you're trying to repair and you're trying to look through with your AR glasses, you look through the guidance on what you're supposed to do, how do you turn the page? Just simplistic. It'd be a lot better than turning a page on a manual, but how do you control your interface when you're already hands are full as a surgeon, hands are full because you're or unable to be used because you're wearing PPE, if you're a deep sea diver, if you're an astronaut. So imagine that not only does it track where you're looking, once you look at what you're interested in, you can then select it. So the simplest probably description is you've got three screens up in front of you and you want to select that icon on the top right screen. And you look at it because you've got earphones in both ears, which we're all wearing anyway. You look at that icon and then you intuitively select it because this muscle is going to be trained a bit like changing the gear of a car. You don't even think about it. It just happens. So imagine if you go, I want that icon, and it selects, and with it seamlessly without you thinking about it. But with AR, you do that, but equally, it will pick up, are you looking at the AR screen? Are you converging your eyes to look at something that's near to? Are you looking through at the distance? So it'll be able to become a sort of seamless control for AR. And as AR becomes into sunglasses and things like that, you know, where AR will become the interface, this, I believe, is the way that we're going to be controlling that interface.
And it's interesting because I'm a massive gaming nerd and I have my own Oculus headset and I play games on it all the time. And I just assumed that natural progression in terms of development of this tech would be eye tracking because you already have these goggles on. And it didn't cross my mind that, you know what, there's an alternative solution. So just tell me a bit about why not eye tracking. Why wouldn't we go down the eye tracking route specifically for applications in AR and VR?
I think this is additive. Sometimes technology is additive rather than replacing. So I think there's situations where either will be better. I think there'll be situations where both will be additive. And so particularly on the go. So, you know, you haven't got anything over your eyes. You're you've got your iPhone or something in front of you, or so basically your interface picks up what you're looking, where you're looking. So you may have cameras looking outwards that actually know that you're looking at a door. It unlocks the door because you come close to it. It picks up a QR code or something on the door. So I think what I've always said is that our applications are not going to be the really exciting ones, because it's a bit like the person who designed the mouse or developed the mouse, who unfortunately developed it 60 years too early, and I don't think he ever got any royalties on it, because it was too early for what the computers could do. Whereas I think we're spot on time, and we are just the new computer mouse in your ear, the three-dimensional controller, the new human-computer interface that doesn't need any invasive technology, doesn't need holes bored through your skull or stents fed up through into your vasculature and your brain. So I think we're already using these devices, earphones. Let's make them multifunction. And with gaming, yeah. The other thing is, because we're picking up your heart rate response, your variability, your respiratory rate, and also which way you're looking, I see gaming becoming completely responsive, knowing where you're looking, knowing where you're listening. And actually, so sending in, putting up the tempo when you're not excited enough, and knowing that you're looking to the left, so it's sending your enemy from the right. So, you know, it will know your intent before you actually realized it yourself. And so the game will become so interactive and so responsive to you that you won't be able to win.
Yes, yeah, so exciting. And tell me a bit about the application now in disabled gamers as well, because this is going to be huge and it's going to completely change the esports industry as well. Because you have this new subset of individuals who have previously been disadvantaged, right? Because they, for example, they might not have full function of their hands. And so, like other people, they aren't able to control a mouse with precision accuracy. And so I'm not sure if you're aware of the Call of Duty game Warzone, but that was massive over lockdown. And for that game, you need precision accuracy to aim the gun and obviously shoot the gun. And I remember thinking to myself, because my friend at the time, he had an injury during football. It was very minor, but he ended up spraining his arm. And for about a week straight, he just couldn't play with us because he couldn't control the controller. And so this is going to be huge. So tell me a bit about this application now for disabled gamers, because it's exciting.
We're certainly not the people who are first on that. There's a massive following for assisted gaming. There's a team in the US who is a very successful team called Quad Gods, who've all quadriplegic. They're linked with Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And we've been in contact with one of the people involved with that. And so they are an expert gaming team. And so to add an extra ability to play, absolutely fantastic. And not just obviously esports, just across the general gamers and opening up for everyone. Because we now know, obviously, the internet provides that way that everyone can be involved, just as it has with virtual working. So yeah, absolutely. Anything we can do to help with that. That is where the journey started, was actually to empower people to live longer, live better. And we're also working with the Scott Morgan Foundation, who was set up by Peter Scott Morgan, who was a roboticist and futurist, who just believed that everyone should have the right to thrive. And unfortunately, motor neuron disease did take him, but his legacy lives on. And I'm one of the patrons for them as well. We're pushing this forward. There's lots of people interested. It's just getting that traction. So what I'm hoping is, once we get our first switches out there, people will just learn by using that actually this is necessary for everybody, and will help us pursue this and get it out to people as quick as possible.
Yeah. And your passion for the solution is clearly evident. And so let's speculate 10 years, 15 years into this future. Tell me about your perfect vision for how this technology is being used on a day-to-day basis for every person. Because if you think about it, the possibilities are endless. We've seen self-driving cars, but imagine controlling your car and the movement of your car through your ears, right? This is the vision. So tell me a bit about this vision.
That's interesting. My vision is that actually you won't even know it's there. You would just be doing it without even thinking about it. So it will just be in your smart earphone. You have a few sensors in your smart earphone, little holes that you don't know why they're there. You know, just another sensor. Buy your smart earphone from the same stores that you've already bought it from or whatever exists in 10 years' time. And you will put them in your ear and you won't even think about it. You will just intuitively control your house by switching on lights as you walk in, just by looking at them. You will monitor your health and fitness at a medical grade level. So everyone's fitness tracking at the moment, but imagine, and no, but lots of these fitness trackers aren't medical grade. It gives you beat to beat blood pressure. So cuffless blood pressure, people, there's a very well-known cardiac timing measures that you can do, and we're going to put that in the air. So all your biometrics will actually predict your, will learn from your normal baselines, because baselines obviously are very variable. It will rate your health and fitness appropriate to figures appropriate to what you're doing at the time. It says you're exercising and this is the blood pressure spike that we're expecting. But actually, one day your heart rate variability is not as good. So are you getting COVID again? It will protect you in advance for chronic diseases. I believe it will pick up early stage acute diseases. It will allow virtual wards and hospital homes to work seamlessly. It will be within people's hearing aids. So that's one of the projects we just got with UKRI, Innovate UK grant. We're looking at putting our sensors small enough to go into hearing aids. So the people who are in the cohort who are most likely to wear hearing aids are obviously tend to be older. They tend to be the ones who most gain from health monitoring. And they may include the people who are least likely to take on a wearable. But these people are wearing a wearable already. So let's make sure every single hearing aid that the NHS provides has to have biometrics. So then these people who might not be interested in tech at all can stream their data up to their medical carer, whoever that might be at the time, and have early warning. When they collapse, we know then with the telemetry, did they drop their blood pressure? Did they get bradycardic? Was it a trip? And even if they haven't got 5G or don't want 5G connection, the paramedic turns up and scans their hearing aid after they've fallen and knows what happened at the time rather than trying to glean it from someone who didn't know what happened. So I think it would just become part of our life. We won't even think about it. The mouse is on my desk here. I don't even think about a computer mouse. It's there. It's just part of us. And I think if you say, what will we be 10 years' time? I think part of us.
Yeah. And it's interesting because my room, in terms of the lights, the Dyson fan, just the temperature of my rooms, it's controlled by Alexa at the moment. So I just say, Alexa, turn on the bedroom, and it will turn on the whole bedroom, and all the lights will come on, etc. And it's funny because I was actually at my friend's house the other day, just sat there and wanted to turn the lights off. And I said it, Alexa, turn off the lights. And I did it without thinking. So it's going to be like that. You just get into the habit. It becomes habitual, right? You just do it without thinking and it will just happen. It's so really exciting. And what I wanted to get onto now, Nick, if it's okay with you, is a lot of the entrepreneurs or founders I get on the show, they would, if they are a GP, for example, they would have gone into GP practice having already building a solution, building a company in mind, and would have maybe gone into the GP because of the flexibility that they could work part-time. You're a bit different, right? You went 20 years as a general practitioner and then decided, actually, I'm going to work on this innovation and you really kickstart your journey in building this company. So give me some advice that for any entrepreneurs or inventors out there who maybe are deep in their career, right? Deep in, whether it is their 20 years into general practice or 20 years into surgery, whatever medical profession they're doing, and then decided actually it's a daunting task to step out to work on something completely different. Tell me a bit about some advice you could give those people.
I can only sort of talk from my experience, which may not be typical, but I guess there'll be other people in the same situation. I was lucky actually, because I was wondering whether I could reach 55, which I did. COVID had extended things a bit. So before I retired, I'd been a GP partner for most of those 21 years, but the last two, I was no longer the partner. But I'd done a lot of the management within the practice, contracts, QOF, enhanced services, in employment, HR, stuff like that. And being a partner, you're really trapped, locked in, which is very difficult. So in some ways, I had an easy out. Because if it hadn't worked, I'd have gone back to Locomy, or I'd gone to Locomy. So I had an easy way. I'd achieved my career in that state. I'd managed to survive in general practice, which has its own issues at the moment, and reasonably successfully. To say this in the opening is very difficult, because some people will always feel that you haven't done the best by them. And hopefully I did my best. So it was very easy for me to step out. Whereas of what I see now, particularly in the NHS Clinical Entrepreneurs Programme, is there's a lot of people at your stage who are making that decision. Do I continue with my career now, or do I take that risk? So I suppose the portfolio route of part-time is a really good route, which gives you that benefit of both, because as a clinician, you are ideally placed to learn those pain points. And occasionally, I think some people step out. For some people, medicine's not right, even though they've done a medical career. And I don't think people should stay in if it's not for them. But equally, if it is for you and you want to do something entrepreneurial, it's worth learning where the pain points are. And until you've actually really felt them, the systems that don't work, the patients who just fall through the cracks, the inefficiencies. Now, one of my platforms is to try and support or suggest that the NHS supports better the entrepreneurial spirit or the intrapreneurial spirit in the NHS so that people don't have to step out of the NHS to make changes. And a lot of people, I believe, on the NHS Clinical Entrepreneurs Programme, which I think is absolutely fantastic, and I would certainly recommend getting on it, and I'm sure you should, are doing it commercially because there wasn't a route through in the NHS. And after 20 years of bashing your head against the brick wall to try and change systems, before that, you stop trying because you know it won't work. And actually, that's the advantage of being in a GP practice, is that you do have a little bit of autonomy. But I think the partnership model for me is probably not working anymore. So I think things have changed a lot. But I think it's choose your pain point. For those of you who are nearer my age, it's easy. You just take that step. You've got the backup of early retirement. For people who are younger than us, I don't know. It's a difficult one.
Yeah, it's interesting because some people say it's easier whilst you're young, whilst you have the ability to take risks. But I'd argue maybe not, because you don't have the stability of what happens if it doesn't work. Whereas maybe when someone gets to your age, for example, it's the fact that you have the comfortability that if it doesn't work, you know what, it's not the end of the world. But so what's next then, Nick? What's happening next in the next couple months to years?
We've literally set up an ear metrics lab. So a lab to basically improve and develop our ear metric sensors, multiple biometrics in your ear. That's with this UKRI grant. So we've got 5 staff that we've just taken on literally over the last couple of weeks. We were massively lucky to get multiple fantastic applicants, which always makes it really difficult. But so these are the ones we've got, fantastic. So this is the first time we've been able to bring our knowledge really in-house, because up till now we've relied a lot on, and still do, gain a lot from university collaboration. So all of our grants were written with universities and some commercial companies, suppliers and technology suppliers. Whereas now we're bringing that knowledge in-house, which means you don't have to go for grants when you don't know whether you're going to get them. Grants take a long time to make a decision, and then you have to have quite a very formulated project plan. And actually, you want to run, as a company, you want to iterate. Now, obviously, you can't move fast and break things. I wouldn't want to, because actually is completely inappropriate. I know that's one of these technology terms. And everyone's very aware of Theranos and things like that. You cannot overpromise, and you have to do things that are based in truth. So we are now being able to move very fast with a lot of the learning that we've had over the last 2 years, bring them in-house and put them together quickly. So that's where we are. We are looking, we're going to get out to evaluation units so that people can actually use our units and actually see where they feel the benefit is. Those are both on the control side and also on the biometrics and the health and fitness side. But we're also going down the route of actually moving towards as if we're going to produce medical grade biometrics. And part of that is the proof, the clinical proof. So we're looking to work with NHS Trust. We've got quite a few that are very interested regarding working alongside the virtual wards of hospital at home, intensive care units to validate our arterial blood gas against arterial blood gases, looking at blood pressure validation from the ear. So a whole bunch of things going on. But the great thing is now there's such a good team. And as they say, is surround people, yourself with people that are better than you. I come up with the mad ideas, I validate them and patent them. And now we need people who are experts at that technology and also the commercialization, the route to market, all those terms I'd never even heard of a few years ago. But rapidly. Yeah. Yeah. So it's podcasts like yours that's really, so yours is fantastic. The one I gained from before I came across yours was one of your competitors, so James Somerow.
Not even a competitor, honestly, inspiration, if anything.
Yeah, yeah.
His podcast is really great. And I guess I wanted to bring a different approach, which is from the student perspective.
Yeah.
Any younger clinicians wanting to get involved in health tech, med tech, wanted to hear about journeys, but then also hear about my perspective as a student.
Absolutely.
Can you listen to this podcast? But yeah.
And the NHS, for students out there, the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Scheme is not just for qualified staff. So there are students on that. It's run by Prof. Tony Young, who's a urologist. He's done an amazing job because you get exposure that you would never, ever get if you didn't have that link. I presented the Royal Institute at the 75th Anniversary Innovation Showcase for the Accelerated Access Collaborative, which is the sort of NHS overarching innovation. And we, it was just, you know, Dragon's Den style thing. So the people in the room, I was introduced to Amanda Pritchard and I talked to her about what we were doing. And you would not get that unless you're on this program. Yeah. If you've got, and you don't have to have a fully formulated idea, you have to be, have that entrepreneurial mindset or intrapreneurial. My wife happens to be on it as well, completely separately. And hers is to do with a completely novel way of doing things within a service within the NHS. And if you've got a good idea, don't feel you have to be commercializable solution. You have to trust yourself is worth doing. And the things that will really fly is when the person has the passion and knows that they're doing a good thing. It's not the money generation. It's actually finding what drives you, I think.
Yeah. And the entrepreneurial program is something that I guess I have looked into and something I will be applying for in the next couple of years, because everyone speaks so highly of it. It's just an opportunity to meet like-minded people and also build upon experiences with each other. And so what advice would you give any students out there listening who maybe don't have specifically an idea but are looking to apply to this program to reap the benefits?
I think it's difficult for me to necessarily advise, because I'm coming from my own mindset and where I was. Was not business, I suppose. As a kid, I was trying to sell a couple of software programs that I'd written. So I suppose I had it in me, but I think you do it for the right reasons. If you haven't, I've seen some people who've gone with an application I think there isn't necessarily a need for, and they're almost searching.
Yeah,
and so
forcing it, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've got to believe. It's not, I want to become a businessman, I want to earn lots of money. That doesn't work, because I think people will see through you and see actually there isn't a passion for what they're doing. There was a lovely term that I came across, was founder market fit. Are you the person who should be coming up with a solution? And if someone thinks you've just jumped on the bandwagon because you can see a niche and you don't actually believe it, or it's you haven't researched it enough. Yeah, you don't have to be that formulated for NHS clinical entrepreneurs, but I think it's a passion. I think that's what makes a difference, is knowing that someone wants to resolve an issue, and it doesn't matter, they're not sold on a particular solution. It's just, I want to make this better and I'm willing to work as hard as I can to know the problem and actually find that solution.
Yeah, great advice there. And as we close up the podcast, Nick, it's been amazing talking to you and amazing having you. Any final words, any last call of action for anyone who maybe wants to start their entrepreneurial journey, or just in general, anyone who is interested in what you've spoken about and maybe wants to get in touch and get involved in what you're doing?
I think listening to podcasts like yours is a great way of learning from people, and everyone will give you a different answer. I heard that you had Alex Young, wasn't it?
The other one.
I listened to him when he was on the Health Tech podcast before. And you're getting some, and I don't include myself in this because I'm new to this, but some amazing people here who've got all sorts of different aspects. So I think I would devour podcasts so that you just get to learn where the pitfalls are, what people are looking for, and just give you some ideas of what might fly. Definitely look at the NHS Clinical Entrepreneur Scheme. Just talk to people. People are normally very happy to, as long as you've got, they think you're doing it for the right reason, to talk to people. And just follow us. We're on LinkedIn at earswitch.co.uk as our website. Really be delighted if people follow us, and we will hopefully be having new posts coming up in the future. We hope to be expanding rapidly. And good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck. And then when it's far, it is hard work, but it's not the sort of hard work that was being a GP. I will work late into the evenings, but it's, you know, I make sure I spend my evenings with my family and they all go to bed and then I start working. It's enjoyable work. It's stuff that you can really feel you're doing good.
Yeah. So thank you so much for coming on, Nick. And it's been a pleasure having you, honestly. Amazing conversation. And I'm really excited to get this out there for the listeners. So yeah, thank you so much. And we should definitely stay in touch.
Fantastic. Very good luck. And I think what you're doing is great. So yeah, you should become a clinical entrepreneur. You definitely have what it takes.
Thank you so much.